From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. First of all, happy birthday to my daughter, Christina. Got to get that in. And later tonight, lucid dreaming. Here's what's happening. If you like to eat tuna, listen to this story. Mercury concentrations in Hawaiian yellowfin tuna are increasing at a rate of almost 4% or more a year. That's high. According to a new University of Michigan-led study that suggests rising atmospheric levels of the toxin are to blame. Mercury is a potent toxin that can accumulate to high concentrations in fish, posing a very severe health risk to you, people who eat large marine fish, such as swordfish or tuna. Now, in the open ocean, the principal source of mercury is atmospheric deposition from human activities, especially emissions from coal-fired power plants and gold mining, they say. The technology behind genetically modified crops is safe, according to a scientific consensus. And the outgoing science advisor to the European Commission in her first full broadcast interview since leaving Brussels, Professor Anne Glover, defended her stance on GMOs as she denied reports that she was sacked, saying that she intended to leave. The professor, who is a former chief scientific advisor to the Scottish government, was accused of presenting a one-sided partial opinions in the debate over GM crops. She had argued opposition to GMOs was a form of madness. Many packaged meals and snacks for toddlers contain worrisome amounts of salt and sugar, as we suspected, potentially creating an early test for foods that may contribute to obesity and other health risks, according to a new government study there. And U.S. consumer spending recorded its biggest decline since late 2009 in December, with households saving the extra cash from cheaper gasoline. Let's check in with Michael Mish Shedlock here. Mish, we kind of saw this coming. I did, at least. How about you?
We did. We talked about it last time, and it's so amazing. And not everyone was talking about that report today, but there was another one that came out today. Total construction spending was weaker than expected, and residential construction actually contracted year over year. Interesting Fed study came out today, George. You're going to get a kick out of this. A Fed study, the San Francisco Fed, came out, and they said that the Fed has been persistently over-optimistic about economic growth since 2007. And, you know, my God, we've known this for how many years?
Yeah.
They're just now figuring this out, George, and they're coming up with some explanations. You know, well, they missed the warning signals about the imbalances before the crisis. They overestimated what monetary policy can do, and then there's a natural tendency of forecasters to extrapolate the recent data forward. I think that's one of the things that happened here, George. Janet Yellen met with congressional Democratic senators last week, and she told them the growth was strong. Why? Because third quarter GDP was really strong.
Mm-hmm.
I told you I thought there would be a payback. And I'm going to tell you what I think it is, you know, why they miss. They've got too much faith in their models, George. They run these economic formulas. They say, oh, if we do this, the consumers are going to do this.
And they don't.
And they don't. That's it in a nutshell. Plus, there's a bias from actually a lot of the industry for favorable reports. They want people to go out there and buy stocks. They want people to go out there and buy bonds. They want people to believe things are better. If things are really bad, is the Fed going to come out and say, you know what, things are really bad? No, they're going to say things are a soft patch. So the Fed just finished upgrading their economic forecast to 2015. I think we're going to start seeing some downgrades.
Yeah, that's just what we need. All right, Michael, thank you so much. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the White House urging individuals and parents to vaccinate themselves and their children amidst an outbreak of at least 100 measles cases now originating from the Disney theme parks in December. The virus declared eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. It seems to be back now. Let's check in, of course, with Gary Ridenour, the expert on pandemics. Gary, let me ask you about this. I mean, 100 cases of measles doesn't seem like a lot. Why do they seem to be panicking so much?
Well, they're panicking on the fact that it's based on the most damaging medical hoax in 100 years, that on a fraudulent scientific paper in 1998, they're afraid that these cases will, you know, there might be a viral mutation, it may continue to spread. The anti-vaccine people are a national health and security problem. And Novak, we need a federal law that says no vaccines, you're homeschooled, because it's gross medical misjudgment. There are tons of papers out there that show that there's no relationship to autism and the shot. Japan in 1989 stopped the MMR shot and suddenly had 265,000 cases of measles. And during a five-year period where they did not give the shot, autism rates continued to climb.
You know, I got an email this morning from someone who said, you never have anybody on who supports vaccines, only people who don't. How many times have you been on the show now, Gary?
I've lost count, but I'd love to come on some night and go toe-to-toe with somebody who's anti-vaccine.
You're pro-vaccine, so there you are.
Yes, definitely. When a vaccine works, I'm pro-vaccine. I mean, the flu vaccine, you know, was a disaster.
That was a disaster. I think everybody needs to look at every vaccine individually, don't you think?
They do, and the Japanese have a three-part vaccine if you want to get it, but just look what would happen if everyone in the United States stopped getting smallpox immunizations and we had a sudden outbreak of smallpox. It would be disastrous.
All right, Gary, always appreciate your feedback. The first large-scale trials of two experimental vaccines against Ebola have begun in Liberia. The medicines were taken under strict security to a secret location. In the West African country, scientists aim to immunize 30,000 volunteers, including frontline health workers. More than 8,500 people have died in this Ebola outbreak that hit Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone. Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog, the American groundhog, famous for his weather predictions, saw his shadow after emerging from his burrow atop the Gobbler's Knob in Pennsylvania, forecasting six more weeks of winter. All this morning, all today, all I heard people talking about was that botched play by the Seattle Seahawks where they could have won the Super Bowl against New England. What a mess. It didn't happen. But why? The numbers lady, Glynis McCants, she predicted New England a long time ago. How'd you see that coming, Glynis?
Hi, George. What I do every year when I look at the Super Bowl is I look at the coach, I look at the quarterback, I look at the personal year cycles they're in, I look at location of where the game will be and the day of the game. And then when you get all that information, I'm able to decide, hey, who's going to win the game, especially when it's obvious. So here's what's fascinating. You know, through what we've talked about through the years, the number one, when you hear me say one, I say one strive to win, correct?
Yep.
You've heard me say that.
Many times.
Well, correct. Tom Brady this year entered the personal year cycle of one. Coach Belichick entered the personal year cycle of one. Now, the coach is a one life path, so that whenever your life path is the same as your personal year, it bodes well for you. Tom Brady is an eight life path. I told you at the beginning of this year that 2015 is an eight. When the world number is the same as your life path, that's a good sign. Then the University of Phoenix, the stadium, broke down to the numbers 911. New England Patriots broke down to the number 911.
It was a match.
Here's what happened with the Seahawks.
Okay.
This is also
this is fascinating. Go ahead.
Russell Wilson was on fire. He's a three life path and a personal year of three, and the guy has the charisma. People love that man. So his numbers look good for winning. The coach had a problem, and here's why.
Uh-oh.
He's a four life path, and this year he entered a year of five, which is toxic to the four, and completely can turn your life into an unexpected drama.
It was.
No one's getting over what happened, are they?
Not at all.
It's shocking.
It's going to be going on for how'd you like to be those Seahawk players? You got to go through a year before the season starts again and live with this.
Exactly. But no matter what, Last year when I looked at the numbers and you and I talked about this, I told you both men, Pete Carroll was a four life path in a personal year of four. Russell was in a personal year of the master number 11. His destiny number was 11. And I said, I think it's his destiny to win this year. That was last year.
We could have taken you to Vegas, Glynis. We could have made some money.
Really exciting.
All right. Glynis' website, numberslady.com. A few weeks ago, I had John Greenwald on the program, the owner of the Black Vault. He had great stories of UFOs, but he also was telling us that he was able to get, of course, the Project Blue Book files into a PDF format so that everybody would have access to it. Well, now he had to take it all away. Somebody else apparently has the copyright, a company called Fold 3, they post military files. They claim they have a digital copyright over the files. He can't use it anymore. But speaking of the files, up next, Kevin Randall joins us. We're going to be talking about Project Blue Book next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Kevin Randall with us, one heck of a UFO investigator for more than 45 years, studied the UFO phenomenon in all various incarnations. His training by the Army and the Air Force provides him with a keen insight into the operations protocols of the military and how they look into UFOs. He has interviewed hundreds of witnesses who have been involved in everything from the Roswell, New Mexico crash in 47 to the radar sightings over Washington, D.C., that incredible case in 1952. Noted author as well, the Government UFO Files, Reflections of a UFO Investigator, Crash. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Kevin Randall. Hey, Kev, good to have you back.
Well, it's about time, George. Been waiting for you to call.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you are back. And since you've been away, this Project Blue Book story is strange, bizarre. They release things, and then there's a company that says they've got the digital rights, but you've looked at the files. What do you think about all this, Kevin?
Back in 1976, when I was taking ROTC with the Air Force, there was a circular came around that said that the Project Blue Books had been declassified and were available for research at Maxwell Air Force Base. I said, great. I'll go take a look at it. I called an editor at Saga Magazine. They used to do the UFO report. I always thought of it as my scholarship to college because I'd write an article for them each semester, and they would pay me just enough that I could almost cover my university bill. I was $10 short.
That's not bad.
I thought so, too. And of course, you'd call the editor. They wouldn't want to call you back or anything. And I called them one day, and I just said, you know, I can get the Project Blue Book files. You know, they wouldn't talk to me. They left a message with the secretary. And within 10 minutes, I got a call from the higher-up editor saying, and giving me all these instructions. I said, well, I understand I have the assignment. He said, well, of course. So I went down to Maxwell Air Force Base with Bob Cornett. We got there. They allowed us on the base. We got to the archives, and they weren't going to let us see anything. Suddenly, this guy from Washington shows up, Mr. Smith, and he says, give these guys what they want. So we got a little research room, and they didn't tell us much of anything. So we were asking about specific cases, and I finally said, do you have an index? They brought this big, thick book to us,
yeah,
which had all the cases listed in it, all the witnesses, and what the outcome was. So Bob Cornett and I spent about 2 days writing down everything that we could about the unidentified. So we had all the witness names. When they were released into the public, the witness names were redacted. So we could put all the names back into the unidentified cases. But if you read the files, you go through the files, you could figure out pretty much who the witnesses were. In fact, in the Arnold sighting, they'd even gone to the point where crossing out Kenneth Arnold's initials, the K-A, so you couldn't figure it out. And across this transcript of a telephone interview with Arnold, somebody had written in grease pencil in letters about a half an inch high, Arnold sighting. So they didn't redact them very well.
No, not at all.
So the point simply is, back in 1976, the files were declassified, and if you happen to have this one little key bit of information, you could get there and take a look at them. Eventually, they were moved to the National Archives, and Jack Webb was going to do a program called Project UFO. I don't know if you remember that or not.
I remember that, and I remember Jack Webb, Dragnet.
Well, he paid to have them microfilmed, so that we all could buy rolls of the microfilm.
Yeah.
I eventually managed to collect all 96 rolls of the microfilm. So I have a complete set of the Project.
Jeez, old technology, but it worked.
Yes, yes. So I've got the thing so I can look the stuff up. I don't understand how Fold 3 can claim that they have a copyright on these files when it was collected by public monies, the Air Force doing it.
That's right. These files belong to us, Kevin. They belong to the public.
Yes.
Let me explain Project Blue Book to some of you who may not know what it is. You might be too young to understand this, but it started in 1952 by the Air Force. It was the third study of the kind to investigate UFOs. One was called Project Sign. That came out in 47 during the Roswell episode. Another one was called Grudge. And then Blue Book started. That was the big one in 1952. It had two missions, two goals. One was to determine if UFOs were a threat to national security and also to analyze UFO-related data. And the fact that they even put this together and it was the third basic study, Kevin, to me was amazing, wasn't it?
Well, yes, but actually it wasn't the third study because in 1946, an unofficial study began at Wright Field under the command of a guy named Howard McCoy. And those files, that unofficial study became the first official study, but all those files now are apparently buried under the golf course at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Buried?
They dumped all the files because there was stuff in there that preceded the Arnold sighting. And they were gathering stuff on the Ghost Rockets. They were gathering stuff on the Foo Fighters. And all that stuff was being gathered starting in 1946, December of 1946. So before Arnold even got on the radar, they had been investigating these aerial phenomena. So Arnold kind of brought it to the public's attention in 1947. And then they started Project Sign. They said they called it Project Saucer. That was the public name, but it was really Project Sign. And then they said in, I think it was 1949, well, we've studied the flying saucers. There's nothing to them. We've ended our project, and we've done a final report, and that's it. All they did was change the name to Project Grudge and continue on the investigation. Then when we get to 1952, they did the same thing. Well, there's nothing to it. We ended our investigation, and they began with Project Blue Book, which they ended in 1969, but they continued to investigate under something called Project Moondust.
I remember when they tossed everything to Condon in, I think it was in Colorado, right? Colorado University.
University of Colorado.
And he came out and basically said, you know, there's not much to any of this. Is that a cover-up? Was that
Absolutely.
A cover-up?
Oh, absolutely. And it can be proved by the documentation, some of it in the Project Blue Book files. One of the things that Bob Cornett and I found as we were going through the files was the administrative files. And we found that there had been like 10 years of the Air Force attempting to move Project Blue Book from the Air Technical Intelligence Center to the Public Information Office, to lose its status by doing something like that. They told Condon, a guy named Robert Hippler, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hippler, wrote to the Condon Committee and said, here's what we want you to find. We want you to say something positive about the Air Force investigation. We want you to say that there's nothing to it, so we should end the investigation, and you should say there's no threat to national security.
Oh, my God. So they basically told him what to say before you even studied it.
And Condon said, yeah, I got that. And when the project ended, that's exactly what they did. But here's the interesting thing. Supposedly, some of the guys with the Condon Committee had security clearances. They could see secret materials. They said, well, there's no secret files. And, of course, when you look at the Project Blue Book files, you can see all the ones that said secret, and that they've crossed that off and declassified it. But there was a case that took place in Belt, Montana, and a guy named Lewis Chase, who had been involved in the RB-47 sighting of 1956, which was one of the best UFO cases. He's now the Project Blue Book officer at Maelstrom Air Force Base. So they're talking about this case and what's going on. And at one point, Chase says to him, I can't show you some of this stuff. It's classified and you don't have a need to know. So Chase is telling the official investigator from the University of Colorado, part of the Project Blue Book study, that there's UFO stuff that he has access to, but the UFO investigator from the Colorado University can't see it because it's too highly classified.
When you were looking at some of the files, Kevin, any specific case pop out that was, you know, one of those wow factor cases?
There have been, that's kind of hard to answer simply because there's been so many of them over the years.
All right, well, think of a good one. We're going to take this quick break.
Okay.
Kevin Randall with us, of course, a great investigator. His blog, by the way, and his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You've got to take some time looking at some of the things that Kevin does. We're going to be back in a moment. We'll talk more with him about Project Blue Book on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Kevin Randall with us. He'll be with us next hour as well, too, when we'll take some of your calls. Kevin, of the files that you did look at, there was one, Portage County UFO case. Tell me about that one.
Well, this is what I think of as the Close Encounters chase. If you remember the opening to the movie Close Encounters,
right,
the police officer chasing the light. This is sort of the same story. You've got two deputy sheriffs in Portage County, and they see something off to the west. It flies over them. They begin chasing it through Ohio and into Pennsylvania, watching the thing. It gets close to the ground. It lights up the ground underneath it. It crosses the road a couple of times. So they're chasing across the countryside. Air Force explanation, it was a satellite and Venus. The problem is, and it's in the files, there's a memo for the record in the Air Force files, and it's like 4 or 5 days after this takes place, and it says, well, we basically checked, and there were no satellites visible at the time. You need the satellite in the west, because Venus is in the east, so you've got to have something in the west for these guys to see and lock onto and transfer it over to the east, where then they can see Venus and chase that. So you've got this case where the explanation that's offered, and it's the final explanation in the Project Blue Book files, as a matter of fact, that it was a satellite in Venus. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
And this was Portage County in Ohio?
Yes,
okay.
Ohio, they chased it into Pennsylvania. And you've got a number of police officers involved. You've got more than just one police car. You've got several police cars chasing it. So it looks like the beginning of the Close Encounters movie. And in the government UFO files, I go into great length and detail about the cases. I do a number of other of the cases that come out of the Project Blue Book files, and the explanation being offered by the Air Force doesn't fit with the facts as developed from inside the files themselves.
Were you baffled, and are you still baffled, at the secrecy behind all of this, Kevin?
I think when it began, the secrecy actually began during the Second World War with the Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
And they're concerned about it being some kind of an enemy weapon system. So you can understand the secrecy in them trying to figure it out.
Sure.
When the war ended, nobody cared. War's over. We don't have to worry about these aerial phenomenon. And it wasn't just lights in the sky. It was actually solid craft at times. So it's kind of like the modern UFO phenomenon. So nobody cared. Then you have the ghost rockets in Sweden in 1946, which they suspected might be some kind of a Soviet attempt to intimidate the Swedes. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you learn that's not true. But nobody cared because it was Europe. Then you get to the United States, and these things are seen, and then they don't know what they are. They're confused by it. They don't know what they are. Suddenly at Roswell, they're presented with the solution, but how is the public going to react to this? So the secrecy in the beginning made sense to me. But 70 years later, I don't get it. We can see by studying the Project Blue Book files, we can see their attempts to belittle the phenomenon, mm-hmm. to hide the information, to just
put down
hand
people
out preposterous solutions, and the news media for the most part says, "Yeah, that's right. Sure, we buy that." The solution for Roswell. Well, we were dropping anthropomorphic dummies in high altitude parachute tests in 1957, 10 years after the fact, and these people have compressed this all in their memory, so they think it was 1947. And the news media sits there and goes, yeah, okay.
And of course, one of the goals of Blue Book was to determine if these objects were a threat to national security. So did they conclude they're not a threat?
Oh, no. But you have to remember that the really good sightings weren't part of the Blue Book system, and there's a general officer who said that in a memo in 1969, that the cases that impacted national security are not part of the Blue Book system. And you look at, again, the Maelstrom Air Force case, mm-hmm. where the UFOs actually shut down an entire what they call the flight of 10 missiles, took them offline in a matter of seconds. An outside source is able to disable our retaliatory capability.
It was probably the first of the hacking episodes, right?
Yes, but that is a matter of national security. If the Soviets could figure out how it was done, you know, we make a big deal about it. If they could figure out how it was done, they could take out part of our strategic response to them. That's a matter of national security. So clearly, there's a national security component to this, and that was why Lewis Chase at Malmstrom told the investigator from the University of Colorado, that's national security, we can't talk about it.
What do you think, and I believe that case too, I think the investigators and the witnesses are just too good. What do you think those occupants of those craft, what were they trying to prove when they shut down the missile silos?
That they could do it. I think they wanted to see if they could do it, if there was a way of doing it. There are ways of doing it called an electromagnetic pulse, but there was no electromagnetic pulse to have done it in 1967 when those missiles were shut down.
Okay.
We had stopped the atmospheric testing, which creates these electromagnetic pulses. An atomic explosion sends out this electromagnetic pulse. So that explanation, which they kind of offered, doesn't work. But it was also restricted to this one specific flight in this one specific area. It didn't take out all the missile fields around Malmstrom Air Force Base, and so you have to wonder about that. But there's any number of cases like that. If we move outside the Project Blue Book realm, you've got the Rendlesham Forest case, the Bentwaters case from 1980, where the thing is seen near
That's a great case, yeah.
Yes, in England, John Burroughs and Jim Pattison.
Out there in the forest somewhere.
Yes, and they're wonderful witnesses. There's no reason to disbelieve what they say, and yet they're manifesting physical effects from their close approach to the UFO, and the military and the government is kind of dragging their feet in getting them the kind of medical treatment that they need today in today's environment. But we look at this whole thing. You can see the history beginning with the Foo Fighters. They end Project Blue Book in 1969. We learn about Project Moondust, and they say, well, it never existed. There was no such mission ever. The Air Force telling the United States Senator this mission didn't exist. While I was working on the government UFO files, I was scanning through one of the microfilms looking for something, and I thought I saw the words Moondust go by.
Mm.
And so I went back to the file, and I found four cases in September of 1960, all labeled Moondust.
So they lied to members of Congress?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He said this mission never existed. And when the congressman sent them, or the senator sent them, Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico, working with Cliff Stone, when they sent them copies of documents from the State Department that said Moondust on them, they said, well, yeah, the mission existed, we never used it. Would you like to see the documents that show that's not true? The Moondust was deployed. And in 1985, I think they told Robert Todd that, yes, this was a classified project. The new code name is properly classified and not releasable. So we know up to 1985 there was an investigation going on. We know that the project name was changed because it was compromised, and they continue to do it. The Air Force mission is to protect national security from intruders from space, from intruders from other countries, to keep our airspace safe. And to say that we don't investigate UFOs is preposterous. They have to. That's part of their mission. Many of them don't turn out to be alien craft, but that's still their mission.
Was there any reference to J. Allen Hynek, who I admired, and of course, when he left Project Blue Book, you know, he let the world know. He became a believer.
Hynek's name shows up in the Blue Book files all over the place. I mean, he was the Air Force consultant on this sort of stuff. In one of the cases, and I think the Air Force actually got it right, was the Child Witted case from 1948, and they see something flash by, and they both describe it as a cigar-shaped craft with square windows. I think that the original response was that it was a meteor. I think that's right based on other evidence that I've seen today. But Hynek's, I think, original idea was, yeah, it was a meteor. And then they said, well, maybe not. And I think that what we see as our science advances, we see how that perception can be made and how others have seen similar things and thought it was a cigar-shaped craft with square windows on it. So yeah, they got it right. But Hynek also got a bad rap when the sightings took place in Michigan in 1966.
Oh, swamp gas.
Well, somebody told him a little bit about it. He says, well, it sounds like swamp gas to me. And if you look what he was told, that makes perfect sense. He wasn't suggesting that that was the ultimate solution for everything. He said, just it sounds like swamp gas. And he just caught all kinds of hell for that. And I think that was unfortunate because he was trying to do a good job and he was trying to do what he was paid to do, which was investigate UFOs. And he was also very annoyed that a lot of the good cases didn't make it into the Project Blue Book files. But you take a look at the files, and Hynek had access to them, and I think in a couple of his books he talks about some of those cases. And in the UFO government files, I've gone into some of the same cases because I now have access to the files as well. That you can see where the Air Force, the investigators, are purposely ignoring evidence. The best example, Levelland from 1957. The Air Force and Don Kehoe, who was the head of the National Air Investigation Committee on Aero Phenomena, a civilian organization, got into a big fight over the number of witnesses. Kehoe said there were 9. The Air Force said there was only 3. If you go to the Air Force file and you look at the documentation, there's witnesses at 13 separate locations that saw something on that night.
Pretty good for just 3, right?
Yeah. The Air Force explanation was only 3 saw a craft. Well, that's not true either. And then you take a look at the sheriff in Levelland. He actually got much closer than the Project Blue Book files suggest, although there is one specific thing in the Project Blue Book files that suggests that he was much closer and saw a craft. But his family later said that he was told by the Air Force, you know, just keep it on the QT, don't talk about this, keep it on the down low. And so he did what he was told to do by them. So you look at that case, and then you move to White Sands, and it's just hours after the Levelland sighting stopped. And this is something that I was just investigating this past summer, and there were 4 military policemen at White Sands who saw something, and it got very close to the ground. The Air Force wrote it off as them being fooled by the moon and Venus, but I actually talked to one of the guys, and he said that we saw the craft land. But you look at the files, 3 of the guys are interviewed, 1 of them is not, and they say, well, he was on leave. He was on a 3-day pass. I've spent the last 6 Jeez. Months trying to get the records, the morning reports, which would tell me exactly where this guy was, because they do it. But they didn't talk to this one guy. And the story I'm getting is he was in the hospital because of the close approach of the UFO. And so the morning reports would tell me that. But just today, I got a letter from the National Archives saying, we don't have the records. They must be in St. Louis. I waited 6 months for a response from St. Louis who said, no, we don't have them there at the National Archives. So I sent my letter to the National Archives, and just today I got the letter back and said, no, they're in St. Louis. So now I've got to go back to St. Louis and try to convince
them. I should look for you when I go back there, you know, because I go back there quite often, Kevin. That area, it's on Page Avenue. It burned down years ago, and they had to rebuild it. I wonder if they lost anything.
Oh, yes, they lost a lot of stuff, but a lot of the records can be reconstructed. A lot of people get myself into trouble on this stuff. A lot of guys claim to be Vietnam veterans, and if you check their record, you find out that they didn't serve in the military. And they say, "Well, my records were burned up in the fire."
That's right. No, you're right.
But that's not true. The records may have been burned up. In fact, one of the guys from the White Sands case, a fellow named Glenn Toy, I had sent for his records, and they said, well, it was destroyed in the fire. But I've got other documentation from the Air Force with his name and serial number on it, so I know he was clearly the guy who was there.
Yeah. Well, when I go back, I'll probably go back to end of March or April, if you want me to check that out, if you're not there by then.
I'll do that for you.
What I need is the morning reports for the first week in November, and it's the unit was the U.S. Garrison. It's Detachment Number 5, and it's the morning reports for that. And in morning reports, they would have to tell where every one of their soldiers was who was not present for duty. So
uh-huh.
If the guy's on leave, it says that. If he's on a path, it says that. If he's in the hospital, it says that. And these documents, the morning report should tell me exactly where that guy was. But the fact that they say, well, he was on a three-day path, you're restricted to the distance you can travel because the military didn't want you to get killed in a car wreck trying to get to home or get back. So mm-hmm. restricted on where you can go. You've got to leave a phone number so they can get in touch with you. So when the Air Force investigator came from Colorado to White Sands to interview the four witnesses, they should have been able to get this guy back so he could talk to him. Unless, of course, he's the guy who was in the hospital.
That's right.
And that's what I want to know. And that would suggest to me that they just didn't care enough to interview this guy officially.
And piece it together. What about the case of the Socorro, New Mexico police officer Zamora, who's dead now? He passed away a little more than a year ago.
Yeah. There's some interesting things going on about that, suggesting that it was some kind of a hoax perpetuated by the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology or whatever the heck it is there in Socorro. There's some interesting information being developed on that, but...
I mean, he clearly saw an egg-shaped object take off with a couple little occupants in front of it.
And Hynek investigated that. He was out there within days of the thing. The FBI had a guy out there. The Army had a guy out there. The New Mexico State Police were out there. There were burned areas underneath it where the thing lifted off. There were landing markings on the terrain. So there's not only was it Zamora's observation of this thing, but there was also physical evidence there. And it's one of the few cases, and I say few, I thought it for a while it was the only one, but it's one of the few cases in the Project Blue Book files where there's occupants talked about, and it's an unidentified case. So that's one of the few cases that gets into that. Usually if you saw the creatures from inside, it's written off as a psychological problem.
No, you're right. What about the evolution of the crafts? Because, you know, in the old days, we used to hear things, as you just mentioned, a burned-out circle or tripod pod marks. We don't hear that anymore. How come?
Well, one of the things I want to say is Ted Phillips, who did an awful lot of investigation of the landing trace cases, if you told him what the landing marks looked like, he could describe the craft to you, which suggests predictability, which is one of the scientific things you want to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you there's a tripod landing gear mark. He tells you what the craft looked like based on the evidence there. But it seems that they've evolved into the triangular-shaped objects that we hear about all the time. And the Belgium sightings from 1980, the Phoenix Lights,
yep.
The object, the triangular-shaped object crossing most of...
That Millstadt, Illinois case where the police officers saw the triangle?
Yes. Yeah. And so you say, well, what does that tell you? And it seems to me it would suggest that earlier on we had creatures from another planet system who fly a specific kind of craft here, and now we've got a different group of people studying us. I mean, that's highly speculative on my part. But if you take a look at the aircraft flown by different countries around the world, you know, they have a generally the same shape, but you can tell the aircraft from one nation to another. And if you take a look at the F-117, I saw a film of it once, and it looked for all the world as it was coming into land as it was a dome disc with a triangular landing gear on it, based on the angle and the way the craft is built. So, you know, our aircraft have evolved. The objects that people see seem to have evolved from what they were back in the 40s and 50s into the triangular craft. And I don't know what the reason for that is, other than the speculation.
Kevin, we're going to come back with you. We'll take phone calls. I also want to ask you about, were there ever any photographs in the Project Blue Book files? We'll be back.